Welcome to SCOTUSCast, RICO and Extraterritoriality Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On March 21, 2016, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in RJR Nabisco Inc. v. the European Community. The European Community and 26 of its member states sued RJR Nabisco in the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of New York, alleging that RJR conducted a global money laundering enterprise in violation of several laws, including the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, a federal statute. The alleged RICO enterprise involved the importation of illegal drugs into European countries by Colombian and Russian criminal organizations, with RJR helping to launder their drug money through a cigarette import purchase scheme. Applying a presumption against extraterritorial application of federal law, the District Court dismissed the European Community's civil RICO claim. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit vacated that judgment and reinstated the RICO claim, however, concluding that various alleged predicates for RICO liability had been intended by Congress to apply extraterritorially, and that other offenses asserted sufficiently important domestic activity to come within RICO's coverage. The U.S. Supreme Court granted RJR's subsequent petition for writ of certiorari on the following question: whether or to what extent RICO applies extraterritorially. To discuss the case, we have Richard A. Samp, who is chief counsel at Washington Legal Foundation. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Samp.
The RJR Nabisco case is really a quite important tort reform case. The federal anti-racketeering law, RICO, includes a very powerful private right of action, and it has been broadly used in this country to essentially turn what are routine business disputes into claims that one's opponent is a racketeer. And of course, the reason that people who are plaintiffs enjoy bringing cases under RICO is that it has such powerful tools attached. In particular, it allows for treble damages, and it also allows for recovery of attorney's fees to prevailing plaintiffs. So the question in RJR Nabisco is, RICO already applies here in the United States. Can it be used to cover foreign disputes, so that if you are involved in a business dispute in Europe, can you sue your opponent in the United States under RICO and take advantage of the powerful tools that are part of RICO? Now, the issue of extraterritoriality of U.S. laws has been one that has been litigated heavily over the last 50 years or so. Most prominently, a decision by the court in 2010 by the name of Morrison versus National Australia Bank seemed to put some real brakes on the overseas application of U.S. laws. In particular, Morrison said, quote, when a statute gives no clear indication of an extraterritorial application, it has none. So in the Morrison case, the question was securities fraud. And in that particular case, the securities were exchanged in Australia. However, there was some U.S. Nexus of the lawsuit. In particular, the allegation was that the securities issuers in Australia had failed to provide information about fraud in connection with bank loans within the United States. And so the claim was that U.S. securities laws could apply because of that U.S. nexus. And so what the Supreme Court did in the Morrison case was to establish a focus test. It looked at what is the focus of the statute at issue, and what the court determined in Morrison was that the focus of Section 10B is the trading of securities, and that really the bank fraud in the United States was not the principal focus, and therefore, if you look at that focus, which was activity in Australia, the securities laws would not apply there unless there was something in the securities law that gave a very clear indication of extraterritorial application. And because there was no such clear application, the Supreme Court dismissed the claims. Another very important extraterritorial decision from the court came in 2013 in a case by the name of Kiobel versus Royal Dutch Petroleum. That case involved the Alien Tort Statute, which provides a right of action to aliens for torts in violation of the law of nations. And what typically has happened is that human rights groups have filed ATS suits against United States corporations based on their overseas activities. Typically, the claim is that the host foreign government has violated the human rights of some of its citizens, and that the U.S. corporation, by virtue of its support and tax revenues that it provides to the foreign government, has in some way aided and abetted these violations of human rights. And the Kiobel case pretty much shut the door to those kinds of lawsuits. The holding was that nothing in the ATS indicated that Congress had intended to have lawsuits under the ATS cover overseas activities, and therefore the presumption of Morrison applied. So that brings us to the RJR Nabisco case, which was argued yesterday. The basic factual allegations is that RJR, along with every other major tobacco company and every major liquor company, had been engaged in a money laundering scheme in Europe. And the basic argument was that drug dealers in South America had been selling drugs in Europe, and then they get euros, and then they sold those euros to money dealers in Europe so that they could get dollars in return, and then those dollars were provided to wholesalers for tobacco in Europe, and those wholesalers brought their dollars to RJR and others and said, we want to buy some cigarettes, and RJR sold them their product, which is, of course, what they normally do. So RJR is not alleged to have had any direct involvement with any drug dealers, but it's alleged to have apparently taken cash for the sale of its product, and that therefore they were complicit in money laundering. And it's important to note that this money laundering activity is not alleged to have taken place in the United States. It's alleged to have taken place either in South America or in Europe. So the question is, does RICO apply to these overseas activities? And so I think it's important to go through RICO very briefly. It's a complicated statute. There are three basic prohibited activities that are covered in 18 U.S.C. Section 1962. First of all, people are prohibited from investing the proceeds from any pattern of racketeering activities in an enterprise. And the essential genesis of the RICO statute was to go after organized crime in the United States, and it was and of course the organized crime would generate proceeds, and then they would invest in legitimate enterprises and take over those enterprises. So that's 1962A, which talks about investing the proceeds of racketeering activities. 1962B prohibits acquiring or maintaining control in an enterprise through a pattern of racketeering activity. And 1962C prohibits the conduct of that very same enterprise through a pattern of racketeering activity. Now, the pattern of racketeering activity is a defined term. Basically, it means that you have committed two or more criminal acts from a long list of federal and state laws that are included in RICO. And in this country, the most commonly used predicate acts are wire fraud and mail fraud, because obviously if you're accusing your opponent in a business transaction, business litigation, with fraud, there's going to be mail fraud or wire fraud. And so it makes it very easy to allege at least two acts of mail or wire fraud and to call your business dispute a racketeering activity and to sue under RICO. Now, the principal enforcer of RICO, of course, is the United States government. It has broad powers to go after organized crime and anybody else who has violated RICO and to get an injunction against it and to take the proceeds of any of these racketeering activities and to give lengthy jail sentences to the racketeers. There is also, however, a private right of action that is created under RICO, and that is Section 1964C. That particular provision says that any person, quote, injured in his business or property by reason of a violation of Section 1962 has a private right of action. Now, nothing in RICO explicitly says one way or the other that that RICO itself applies extraterritorially. So I think there's a pretty strong argument that RICO does not apply extraterritorially, applying the presumption that was created in the Morrison case. However, it is true that if you go through the hundreds of predicate acts that are covered under RICO, some of them, such as money laundering, do explicitly apply extraterritorially. So the plaintiffs in this particular case are claiming that that RICO applies extraterritorially to the extent that any of the predicate acts that were committed apply extraterritorially. Interestingly, the plaintiff in this particular case is the European Union, and the original claim that they made was that by virtue of this racketeering activity, various European governments lost tax proceeds. This case was originally filed in the year 2000, but the court said, no, under the general revenue rules, you can't sue in the United States courts for the collection of revenues in this way. So the European Union then amended its complaint, and now their claim is a number of our member states are in the business of selling tobacco, and in some unspecified way, these state enterprises were damaged in their business model by the fact that RJR was able to sell the cigarettes in the manner that it did. Every other one of the plaintiffs, both in the liquor industry and in the tobacco industry, has settled the case, so it is only RJR that is still in court. RJR won its case in the district court on the grounds that there was no extraterritorial application of RICO. The Second Circuit reversed. It said that, yes, RICO does apply extraterritorially to the extent that its various enumerated crimes do apply apply extraterritorially, and for example, money laundering does apply extraterritorially. So the case was granted cert. It was granted cert before Justice Scalia's untimely death. So that's perhaps one less vote that RJR has for it. And the case was argued yesterday. And the principal argument, not surprisingly, of RJR is that the focus of RICO is on activities here in the United States. And the question really comes down to, is the focus of RICO the enterprise that is being corrupted by the racketeer, or is the focus the racketeering activity and the pattern of racketeering activity? If it is the former, and you have to focus on the enterprise itself, then pretty clearly RJR is going to win because enterprise involved in this country, the enterprise involved in this case, the money laundering scheme, It took place entirely outside of the United States, and certainly there is nothing in RICO that would suggest that Congress intended this statute RICO to apply to overseas enterprises. On the other hand, if the focus is the pattern of racketeering activity, then given that some of that racketeering activity consists of predicate acts that are themselves applicable extraterritorially, then there is at least a plausible argument to be made for the EU in this case that they do have a plausible cause of action. The United States has intervened in the case by filing an amicus curiae brief, and the United States, interestingly, took a middle position in the case. What it said was, on the one hand, we think that the focus of Section 1962 that sets forth the prohibitions, that portion of the statute has two focuses. It focuses both on the enterprise and on the racketeering activity. And since racketeering activity, at least some of it, does apply extraterritorially, the United States government says that the prohibitions do apply to activities that occurred in Europe. And so that means, of course, the United States, if it so chose, would be permitted to bring criminal actions against companies that were engaged in activity in Europe that violated one of the predicate statutes. But on the other hand, what the United States says is that we agree with RJR that when you turn to the private right of action created by 1964C, the answer is different. That according to the United States, you must have an injury here in the United States in order to have a cause of action. 1964C creates a private right of action for somebody injured in his business or property, and nothing in Section 1964C gives any indication of extraterritorial application of that injury requirement, and therefore the United States says that in the absence of any real evidence that there was any injury to anybody here in the United States, that the decision of the Second Circuit can't stand. The United States was willing to say the case maybe should be remanded to the lower courts to give the EU an opportunity to establish some sort of injury within the United States, but I think it would be very difficult to show such an injury. So the bottom line really is that the United States is on RJR's side in this case. Now, in the argument yesterday, interestingly, there were only seven justices involved. Sandra Sotomayor apparently was involved in this case when it was in the Second Circuit, so she recused herself so that RJR will only need four out of the seven votes to win. And my very rough head count is the argument yesterday is that probably the four conservatives on the court are going to stick with the decisions that they issued in Morrison and Kiobel and will say no extraterritorial application. That's Roberts, Kennedy, Alito, and Thomas. My guess is that Justice Ginsburg is going to probably vote to affirm, and perhaps Justice Kagan as well. She seemed to think that that you really can't divvy up the statute and say, well, maybe the prohibitions of 1962 apply extraterritorially, but we're not going to apply the private right of action extraterritorially. She seemed to think it should be all one way or the other. So I suspect she may be a vote to affirm as well. Justice Breyer, perhaps, was the most interesting person at oral argument in that he was saying, you know, I want guidance from the State Department and I want guidance from the European community, and I'm just totally confused in this case because normally when we hear from the EU, it's in cases like Kiobel and in various antitrust cases when European states rant and rave about the United States injecting its law into activities things taking place in Europe, and it should mind its own business. Yet in this case, we have the EU in Brussels, presumably speaking on behalf of all member states, saying we do want it to apply extraterritorially here. And he was saying basically the overseas application of U.S. antitrust laws has been a disaster over the years, and why do we want to extend it here to the area of RICO, which is likely to cause even more mischief. So he seemed genuinely undecided as to which way he was going to come out. I would say in general, one reaction I had was that the court was perhaps less focused on this case than it has been on some others. On yesterday morning, the 10 o'clock argument was a very hot bench. The court was arguing heatedly about redistricting standards and whether the Virginia congressional redistricting had been an illegal racial gerrymander or whether it was a mere partisan gerrymander, and the court was very actively engaged in that case, and I think that they were perhaps had used up a lot of their energy by 11 o'clock, and there was not a lot of interest in the case, and all of the attorneys were allowed to argue for extended periods of time without interruption, so that makes it a little bit more difficult to predict how the court is going to rule. But I don't think that merely because the court was perhaps somewhat less interested in the fine points of RICO, we shouldn't interpret from that the case is not important. I think it is highly important. I think that if the Second Circuit is affirmed, you're going to see many more cases of this sort filed. And while RICO has always been a problem domestically, I think you'll find that that RICO will become even more of a problem in the future once people in Europe begin to catch on that they could bring their business disputes here to the United States and take advantage of the treble damages award.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.